The social aspect of creativity is also important because creativity doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Giovinetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan.
For this episode, we're joined by Professor Kerry Friedman to talk about art education, visual culture, and creativity. The conversation covers struggle and flow, the challenges of assessing creative work, the importance of leadership and communities of practice, and what art education can teach other fields and disciplines about fostering and assessing creativity. Kerry Friedman is Professor of Art and Design Education at Northern Illinois University. She's had a long and illustrious career in art education. She's the author of Teaching Visual Culture, an editor and co-author on various other books, and has published over 100 scholarly articles and chapters. Her work has a strong focus on visual culture and on art education pedagogy. So, Kerry Friedman, you're very welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We always start all of these conversations, whoever it is we're talking to, with a standard opening question. And I'll put it to you now. What single word do you associate with the concept of creativity? And you're allowed to use more than one word in justifying your answer.
I've thought about this a lot since you mentioned that you were going to ask me this. The first word that sprang to mind was struggle. And even though I thought about it a lot after that, I still kept coming back to struggle. So I guess that's my word.
Can you explain what you mean? Because that suggests the idea of the agonized creative process, you know, the tortured artist or poet wrestling with whatever they're trying to create.
Yeah, it does. And that's why I was trying to come up with another word, actually, because I didn't want to, you know, to support the old modernist myth that we've debunked over recent years. But, you know, even though that's not what I'm referring to, I still think struggle is a good word, because when one is creative, even though we have this idea that it's the aha moment that is the creative moment, there's a lot that surrounds that. And the struggle involves decision-making, for example. When you have that aha moment, then what? You know, are you sure it's the right one? Is it going to work out? Is it good? There's a lot of practice that's involved to make it actually happen. There's a huge amount of decision-making that goes on to complete the creative process. So I personally write and publish a lot, and I used to paint. My undergraduate degree actually was in painting and printmaking. And then I went on to get my master's and my PhD. So by the time I was finished, I was doing more writing than artwork. But I feel I write like I paint. And it's always a matter of writing and rewriting and editing and making change and clarifying. And as I work through that process, my ideas become, I think, better over time. So I think of it, at least personally, as a struggle.
Does struggle have to imply a unpleasant process?
No, struggle is quite the contrary. Struggle is where I think a lot of enjoyment can be found. You know, we like to think of complicated emotions like love, for example, as if it's easy. Love is not easy. You know, the most wonderful part of love is that it's an ongoing project, sort of, and it always becomes new that way. So I think of struggle as an enjoyable thing. You know, that's something that it's a process that I personally like to go through. And I know a lot of people in the arts who feel the same way as I do, that I've talked to over the years, that it's that wonderful aspect of the struggle that makes creativity so enjoyable. But at the same, I mean, it can be painful too, of course, but it's not the kind of, I think it's not the kind of torment people talked about, you know, in the modernist myth. It's more like a process by which you find enjoyment in the making of something.
That's a great sort of nuance on that perspective. I also like that idea of that analogy of love as a struggle, but also a positive struggle. And I suppose we could get into a whole side angle on the question of whether love is a creative process, but I think we might leave that one for the moment. You touched on it briefly there, but could you just tell us a bit more about your own background as an art educator, as a practitioner, how you got to where you are, and how that sort of informed your perspectives? You mentioned that you did paint, you then moved to be more writing, and how does that all inform your perspective on creativity?
Yeah, it was actually it started much earlier than my undergraduate days. I was placed in the gifted and talented program in junior high school, and I remember making a lot of art before then, but that program gave me a chance to take on these difficult creative projects of my own choosing. That was the point of the program. And that was the first time I remember experiencing what Csikszentmihalyi calls flow. I actually remember feeling that at the time and felt it often in high school and worked to achieve it in high school because it was such an enjoyable feeling, part of the struggle, I guess. And I had a difficult time staying in high school. It was the 1970s. I was involved in lots of bad stuff. I was taking drugs and but also doing things like organizing protests against the Vietnam War, getting kicked out of school for several times for those different things that I was involved in. And I had taken every art class my high school offered, and I started cutting my other classes, and the school created kind of independent studies for me so that in art, so that I could stay in school, I'd stay in the building and graduate. And so I thought of my art teachers as actually getting me through high school instead of, you know, dropping out. So I decided to become an art teacher. And while I was teaching, I began studying my students' creative behaviors without really knowing what I was doing because I hadn't been trained in research. So when I was getting my master's degree, my professors recommended getting a PhD because I was clearly becoming interested in research, which I did. So that's how I got here. That was many years ago, of course.
You said you did paint, but then you've sort of moved away from that now. Do you still think of yourself as a creative practitioner as well as an arts educator?
I do, but I don't think of my artwork as being big C at all. I think of it as small C, and I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy the struggle, but I don't work to show my art like I do my writing. So I think of my creative activity now as writing, and I'm actually starting to write fiction, which I know you've been involved in.
That's very interesting. That's really interesting. I'm particularly interested always in people who are academic writers, but then who possibly straddle the border or shift across into creative writing.
I've got a science fiction series that I've been working on. I've written two books for it, and I'm starting to work on the third now. So.
Oh, fantastic. So there's a sort of interdisciplinarity in your in your creative practice as well, then. Well, that's an entire other sideline as well. There are always sidelines, but before we go into any of the possible tangents, I want to come to the thorny topic of definitions. Academia, whatever field or discipline it is, does like definitions and does like agonizing over definitions. And that's certainly long been the case when it comes to creativity. Now, the sort of commonest, the most pervasive scholarly conceptions of creativity tend to focus on the idea of creativity being a process that results in something new and valuable. Novelty and value are these terms that are often raised. I think from some of the things you've written that you'd probably be inclined to critique or certainly to add some nuance to that perspective. So could you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I agree with the definition as far as it goes. Certainly creativity is a social endeavor. As we were talking about, the old modernist myths have been debunked. Good ideas that seem to birth forest independently are actually fermented through social interactions, being aware of other people's creations and so on. And newness and value are determined in social contexts. So, you know, those are the overt characteristics, things that can easily be checked in a sense. But creativity also has to, in my mind, has to be defined in terms of the application of tacit knowledge as well. Michael Polanyi's phrase for knowledge that can't be put into words is a tacit quality of creativity that makes it hard to define, that keeps people us kind of struggling through the debate of what creativity is. For example, creativity is revealed through the use of material. And I'm just not referring to craft or skill. In art, it's an ability to capture the senses through material and produce complex associative meanings. So it's very difficult to define that. It's very hard to put that into words. The words I just used certainly don't do justice to it. Big C is hard to do. You know, that's one of the reasons why. It's because it demands this tacit knowledge of this material that you're working with. Michelangelo talked about it as finding the sculpture in the marble or in the stone or in the material. We don't talk about it like that very much anymore, but it's the same sense of having to know your material. This is why people need time with material to learn its qualities. People always seem to need a scribbling stage with whatever material they're working with before doing something that would generally be considered creative. Children need that scribbling stage. I did a study years ago on undergraduate students using drawing and painting programs for the first time, drawing and painting software for the first time. And sure enough, they had to have a scribbling stage. They had to just play with the material. So even you know, digital material needs to have that same process of experimentation to understand the material to be able to make something. So I think that tacit knowledge aspect of creativity hasn't been dealt with enough. It's I think very under-theorized.
That's interesting. And something else comes out of what you were saying there, which is the relationship or perhaps the divergence between creativity and craft. And I think you have made the point sometimes in some things you've written that there is a requirement for repetition to develop that craft aspect, which wouldn't be necessarily what we associate with newness anyway, certainly. It's certainly the case that you can have somebody who has really heightened craft skills in a particular area, but doesn't necessarily produce anything particularly innovative, particularly novel. Do you think it's possible to be creative without having those refined or at least post-scribbling stage craft skills?
It would be hard to do because, you know, to get to the big C, of course, in small C, yes, I would say absolutely that's the case. Children are creative all the time. You know, I wouldn't be teaching art if I didn't believe children could make art. But to achieve that big C, that would be difficult to do.
When people who are not necessarily particularly engaged with thinking about creativity, or certainly not with thinking about the theories around it, talk about a creative person, often it seems to me what they're referring to is somebody with craft skills, who very often is creative, but the thing that defines them as creative to the layperson is often their craft skills, which is, as you say, something that requires that scribbling stage, but then also a lot of repetition. Okay, we'll move on to something that in a way is linked to that, which is where creativity sits in different areas, or how it's conceived in different areas. Because when we talk about creativity to people who are teaching in fields that aren't typically seen as creative, that don't have an obvious aspect of creative practice, certainly, they tend to associate it with the arts, as I was just saying. Particularly when you're in a university setting, you talk about creativity, people think, oh, well, that's what they do in the arts department or in drama or maybe the creative writing program. But then when we look at the scholarly literature around creativity, we look at the theories, a lot of which sort of come out of cognitive approaches, the applications, sort of ready applications of it, often work better or seem to be adopted more readily by business studies, by sort of business innovation or areas of design that are not primarily aesthetic. So there's two questions that come out of that. The first one is the creativity of the arts, and then the creativity of business and commercial design, of design thinking and so on, are those the same thing? Is that creativity at base the same thing, or are they two different things? And then following on from that, do you think creativity within the arts is perhaps insufficiently theorized, or perhaps doesn't make a loud enough theory voice?
Yeah, there's overlap between the two, of course, but the material qualities of each are quite different in terms of business and in design. They're obviously the same or similar. But when you're comparing the visual arts, let's say, and something like business, the tacit knowledge and processes required are quite different. So it's hard to say that they're the same. I think I agree that creativity in the arts is under-theorized, as I said before. I think it's drastically under-theorized because historically theory has depended heavily on words. And the tacit dimension of creativity makes it very difficult to put into words. And when we try, the words always underestimate what the arts are and can do. This is what happens when art is reduced to semiotics, which it often is in theory. Even models like art is a language, which has been appropriated in various forms when being theorized, can cause problems because works of art are gestalts. They say a lot more than words can say. We process them differently. Even our eye movements are different. And so it's just very difficult to theorize it. People have tried often, but there still is an under-theorized problem there, I think. Theory is based on argument, which can be demonstrated using non-linguistic evidence, such as visual evidence, but visual arguments are difficult for most people to understand. So it's difficult to reach community agreement. That's part of the problem there.
Something is suggested there, which I'm just going to follow a little bit, which is the question of of assessing creativity. I want to move on in a moment to ask you a few questions that relate to the practice of teaching in a way. So the big question that actually is associated with that is assessing creativity and putting a grade on it. In a way that might be easier within those almost hard process based conceptions that you do get in design and in business. But in a nutshell, how do you approach assessing creativity in an aesthetic context, if you like, in an arts context?
The question about assessment has to do with a couple of questions that we've been talking about and that we will be talking about. One of the difficulties with performing creativity or performing creatively in school is assessment. That's one of the problems for promoting creativity in school. Assessment makes it very difficult to be creative in school. We also have a lot of other restrictions in school having to do with time and, you know, cutoffs of time and many other conditions that make creativity in school very difficult. Arts teachers work very hard to create conditions within those limitations to enable creativity to occur. And I think our teachers are very successful at that as a general rule of thumb, depending on the individual, of course. But one of the ways that we do that is by practicing a form of assessment that, unfortunately, a lot of people in other subject areas don't really understand very well, because it relies on expert knowledge of that tacit condition that we've been talking about. The way that you assess, as a visual arts teacher, the way you assess the quality of student work or what the student has learned or how much the student has learned is by looking at the work. And the only way to make judgments about the work is by having benchmarks that you have in your mind, or you can use physical benchmarks of other student work if you want, that you compare that work to. So you're always assessing visual to visual. We write rubrics and things like that basically to help students and administrators and parents to understand that tacit knowledge. We try to explain it in words, but what actually happens is that, you know, we look at a work of art, compare it to all the benchmarks we have in our head of previous student work, and then are able to make a judgment about it. That's the real process. And there has been research on how art teachers make judgments using analytic versus holistic rubrics. And what happens, and teachers have admitted this in research, is that they look at a work of art, they determine the grade or score or whatever it's going to get, and then they'll fill out the rubric that they have to fill out, right, to equal that score.
Right.
And there's a very good reason for that. It's not a matter of sort of, you know, being dishonest or something. It's because images are assessed visually. They're not assessed in terms of words. And so what happens in their mind is this comparison of visual to visual, and then, okay, now I've got to describe it to someone else.
So that suggests that it would be more or less impossible to meaningfully assess something that was completely decontextualized, something for which you had no point of reference. Would I be reading you right in terms of that?
More or less. I mean, early art teachers can assess student work. The more experience they have with student work, the easier it is for them to do assessments and the more quickly they can do it. But we do teach students when they're in art teacher training how to do that, how to make those assessments. And then the larger the iconic store they build in their mind of benchmarks, basically, the easier it is to do over time. So Yes, context is important, experience is important, but you know, in contemporary life, everyone's got some visual experience. Everyone sees lots of pictures all the time now. So no one's really starting out completely fresh. Once children are born into this environment, you know, they start seeing images pretty quickly.
Right. So we do all have access to the context up to a point.
Up to a point, yeah. Not the context of being in our classroom, but the context of seeing images and making judgments about them and being told how to make judgments about them by parents, for example. It starts very small. You know, it starts in the same way that, you know, a child has a dog at home. They've learned what a dog looks like. They see a cow out the window of a car as they're driving past a field, and they point to it and say, "Dog," and their parent says, "Well, actually, no, that's a cow, and here's why. You know, here's how a cow looks different than a dog." Well, the reason that the child said dog is because it's a four-legged furry animal, and that's what they've experienced before visually. But looking out the window, that four-legged furry animal has some different visual qualities that the parent explains.
Right. That brings to mind those sort of early medieval images, early medieval European images of what to those Europeans were exotic animals of rhinoceroses and so on, which tend to look like a cow with a horn stuck on its head because their point of reference is a cow.
Yeah. And of course, we all hope that parents are doing that. You know, I mean, obviously not all children have that advantage, which you see when children come to school in art education in early elementary school, what parents have been doing that, what parents have been driving their kids to fields and looking at cows, and what parents have dogs at home and so on, and what parents have been pointing out those visual differences, and what parents haven't had those opportunities to do.
It came up in that answer, so I'll go in that direction now, which is about conditions. And you did mention it at the start of that. You've argued elsewhere that creativity should always be sought, but can only be achieved to the extent that conditions will allow. So in a specifically a higher education context, because that's what we're focusing on in this project, within the arts or more broadly, what might those conditions look like for the optimum of creative achievement among students?
Well, changes need to occur in both curriculum and assessment. We talked a little bit about assessment. After teaching for a very long time and reading a lot of research on the topic, it's pretty clear that to promote creativity in classrooms, and we've already talked about the difficulties of that, you know, assignments should be based on projects, be project-based, and they should involve students' own interests, because it's well documented that creativity requires commitment, and it's difficult for students to commit to learning they don't care about. So having those projects based on things that actually interest students is really important for creativity. Assessment also needs to change to enable, as well as the assessment changes we talked about just earlier, it also needs to be changed to enable apparent failure. Educators are often afraid of student failure for good reasons. Failure can lead to a lack of student success in the future, damage to student confidence, even litigation sometimes. You know, it's pretty crazy. But apparent failure can actually be success. That is, learning can have accrued even if a student hasn't achieved a predicted outcome. So we need to shift our attention and language so that we can see and document achievements rather than deficits. And in order to do this, instructors need to be taught how to see achievement based on actual learning, not just predicted outcomes, which is difficult to do. People who teach the arts realize this and are often willing to give good grades when risks are taken, regardless of visible outcomes. That's why art educators use portfolios, for example, because when done right, a portfolio isn't just a collection of work. It actually shows a learning pathway with, you know, preparatory sketches, you know, artist statements. You get to see the apparent failure and the successes together, so you can actually see how much the student has learned and progressed.
It might be possible to take some of that model into other disciplines. I mean, it obviously fits particularly well with arts in terms of the portfolio, but it does seem more open to finding that creativity, finding that risk that you talked about. If we could somehow transfer that portfolio approach into, I don't know, history or sociology or something like that.
Well, some people have tried to do that, and it's certainly possible. One of the reasons that it's easy to do it in art is because we have, you know, the visual arts, for example, we have those benchmarks in our head. It's very easy and quick to look at a work of art by a student, to look at their preparatory sketches and compare them to our benchmarks. It's easy and quick. I've seen and talked to instructors who have students put together portfolios for writing, for example, maybe fictional writing. It's a little bit more difficult because it takes a lot longer to read and process all of the documentation that the student has put together. I think it does work, and I think it's worth doing, but it is harder to do. So in the visual arts, you know, we do have this advantage that, as I was mentioning before, that, you know, visual arts function as gestalt, so it's easy to make those quick judgments and have them be pretty accurate.
Right, because the benchmarks are established and rapidly accessible, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Rapidly perceived.
Yes.
Eye movements are very quick. You know, saccadic eye movements are very fast, and so we're able to perceive an image, for example, a painting or a drawing, very quickly in order to make that assessment. So portfolio is a very efficient way to assess in the visual arts.
So all those other people who are generally assessing text-based work, they could do it. They just probably have to take longer over it and maybe work a little bit harder.
Well, I think there might be a more efficient way to do it, actually. It's just that I think, you know, because creativity is dependent in part on disciplinary specifics, I'm not sure I could come up with just at the moment a way of doing it for writing, for example. But there could very well be a way of doing it that's more efficient. You know, maybe there's a way of developing software, for example, that could help.
That's a creative challenge we'll have to give to somebody to work on that at some point. I just want to roll through towards the end now, as we're beginning to run out of time. But a couple of other questions that relate to that idea of fostering creativity within a classroom setting or within an education setting. You've written about the importance of knowledge transfer within communities of practice. And I think you've written with the specific example of graffiti artists' communities. Why is that social aspect of creativity so key? And how do we go about actively fostering it in a teaching and learning environment?
Well, communities of practice are important because they determine what is new and valuable. They support and push ideas farther than they could be pushed by an individual. They also critique to ensure quality. Even when I was studying graffiti groups and a lot of sort of popular culture, creative practices among young people's visual culture, learning communities of various sorts. Very often they establish their own critique processes. They can be very tough on the other members of the community. I'll just give you one example, which was really interesting to me. I was working with a group of young fan artists, in their 20s. And they had determined that if one of the members of the group doesn't respect the character, that is, they recreate work based on characters that have been created professionally, and they create their own stories to go with those characters and represent them visually in various ways. And they decided that if someone in the group doesn't respect the character, meaning they put a character who is generally good in a situation where they're being evil, they're ousted from the group. That's just completely unacceptable. So these groups kind of make their own judgments about how to ensure the quality of the work. We had another great example from in a graffiti group. Well, not great for the person. Graffiti, as you know, in most places is illegal. And one of the members of the group apparently somehow allowed the police to find out about the group. And the work of that person was no longer allowed to do work as part of the group. And that extended beyond the group. Other graffiti groups in the area no longer allowed that person to work as part of one of the groups. So they were kind of isolated, and their work fell off apparently, and they weren't as successful in their work or weren't as productive. So it's a very interesting process, because communities of practice are not just professional. They're formed even among young people before they become professional, or, you know, even if they never become professional in the visual arts, let's say they just are doing it as a hobby or something like that later in life, they still can be part of a community of practice. It's the members of the community who make determinations about criteria for judgment. The community decides what is good art. That's current practice anyway, and the professional communities as well. So, you know, there's a community of practice that decides what art goes in a museum, for example. The social aspect of creativity is also important, because creativity doesn't happen in a vacuum. People build on each other's ideas, they challenge those ideas, and they combine earlier ideas, like synectic training. You know, that creativity training process is based on the premise that creativity is a new combination of old things, and those old things obviously come from earlier social contexts. So even the most creative artists do that all the time. The Mona Lisa has facial features and a landscape background. You know, how many thousands of those had been created before the Mona Lisa? So like many paintings before, it has the same component parts, but these were handled in a new way.
Right, that nicely problematizes that idea again of novelty. Yeah, absolutely. The Mona Lisa, what was new about the Mona Lisa? Or more to the point, how do you assess it?
In terms of making educational context more open to creativity, I would say one thing we have to do is break down some of the educational silos a bit to broaden communities of practice. So for example, creativity in school would probably be helped if everyone increased their visual arts knowledge. That's one thing that I have been arguing for recently. I'm writing a book right now with a colleague on visual arts, on visual research methods for social scientists. And, you know, our problem in writing this book is realizing that the people we're writing the book for have very little basic visual arts knowledge. And we know that because we've done a lot of workshops on the topic of the book. That's why Rutledge came to us and gave us the contract. We have social scientists come to these workshops every year, and it's very clear that their art education is lacking. So I think just more visual arts knowledge, for example, would help open up those communities of practice and improve education, improve creativity in education.
That's very much in line with our thinking around this project. It's encouraging people to get out of those silos and interdisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity are clearly key factors. We're moving towards the end now. I did want to just briefly ask you about the idea of creativity and leadership. You've itemized it as one of a set of numbered elements of creativity, the idea of creativity as a form of leadership. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, this is a little bit more complicated, and I know we're running out of time. So leadership theorists have argued that leadership requires the courage to take risks. And risk-taking is certainly important for creativity, as we've talked about. I suppose that works in a business model. That particular phrase works in a business model where leadership is conceptualized in terms of a hierarchical position. In art, it's almost the other way around. It's more risk-taking requires the courage to lead. So the business model is leadership. The phrase that's really commonly seen is leadership requires the courage to take risks, but an artist's risk-taking requires the courage to lead. And the reason I say that is because in the visual arts, for example, people lead through new ideas and images and so on. So in other words, because creativity generates ideas in other people, one needs to have the courage to put creative work out in public, knowing that it can have an influence for good or ill. But for example, knowing it will be criticized. So the arts are some of the few disciplines that necessarily involve in education, involve other students seeing student work, even at a young age. And this can take its toll on people. Sometimes young people become afraid to show their artwork and even become disinterested in artwork because of that character of the discipline. It takes a savvy teacher to ensure that students gain and maintain the courage to put their work out there for people to see and criticize. The students who have the courage to influence others, those are the students who are more easily going to take risks. So helping students have the courage to influence other people in positive ways can aid creativity. That's a form of leadership that I'm referring to.
That's actually very clear, and I think it's probably nicely transferable into other disciplines more readily than some of the other aspects that you've talked about. We could go on, and there's lots of things I would like to dig further into, but we are sadly out of time, which means I have to put to you the standard closing question that we put to everyone that we speak to. And that's this: if you had a magic wand, and remember it's a magic wand, so you can do absolutely anything with it, there are no practical or budgetary constraints. If you had that magic wand, what one thing would you use it to change that would help to foster creativity in higher education?
Okay, short of changing the wand entirely and creatively, I would say that the magic wand will require a visual education applied to all fields so that students gain that tacit knowledge and learn to articulate it the way that I've been talking about. And it doesn't have to be magic. This could in fact happen. It just requires creativity. But that's creativity for you. It generates more creativity.
That's perfect, and it's entirely applicable. That's the best kind of magic, the kind of magic you don't need a magic wand to apply. Kerry Friedman, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation, and there are lots and lots of ideas, many of which I think probably are very applicable beyond the arts.
Thank you.
This was another episode of Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast.
In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Cranier Project is based at Dublin City University and is funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education.